I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Today, we're tackling climate change on two fronts. First, we'll speak with architect Gordon Gill. Gordon is responsible for the greening of Chicago's Willis Tower, better known as Sears Tower, among other projects, and he'll tell us how architects are designing mixed-use buildings that are better for the environment and better fits for city living. And we'll talk to Julia Parzon of the firm JP Consulting. She's brought 65 international cities together to coordinate climate action planning as the director of the new Urban Sustainability Directors Network. She'll tell us about the low-hanging fruit for cities that want to make a big dent in their carbon footprint. All that plus the latest from PlanEtizen and our City Views commentator Walker Smith today on Smart City right after this news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Gordon Gill has designed award-winning architecture all over the world. He says his work is guided by a philosophy that architecture must strike a balance with its global environmental context, exactly what he was called upon to do when he was asked to work on lowering the environmental impact of the tallest building in the U.S. Gordon, you are greening the tallest building in the country, Sears Tower, now renamed Willis Tower. It was opened in 1973, more than 30 years ago. What kinds of changes are even possible in such a building to convert it to a green and sustainable building?
Well, there are many things that have happened since the mid-70s on that building. The client groups have actually done a tremendous job on their own bringing the energy down. They've changed lighting. They have looked at the exterior wall, although they haven't pursued that entirely. But what is available to us is a tremendous amount of latent energy because of the sheer scale of that building. At 4 million square feet, that building represents one of the largest buildings in the country. And with minor energy savings, it's equivalent to a pretty significant contribution in terms of carbon and energy in the city of Chicago. So the exterior wall, for example, is definitely available. It's a single glazed system. If that goes to an insulated glass, then the energy savings on that building are tremendously improved. Lighting can afford approximately 35% of a typical office building in terms of energy consumption. If we attack that and are able to reduce that by 30% or more, that's also a significant savings. Just the sheer mechanical systems alone at their age are ready for retrofit or replacement. Those offer significant savings. Things like elevatoring and the mechanical systems and the energy required to move elevators in that building, that is a whole new system that can also yield a lot of savings. We are at approximately 68 million kilowatts per year in terms of savings. Approximately 80% of the base building energy is being saved. That's the equivalent of something like 2,500 single-family homes in the Chicago area. So it's a huge contribution.
When you say it's being saved, do you mean being saved as a result of the plans that you have?
Yes. Yes, that's correct. One of the things that we're looking at, and this building will be the leader, is looking at existing building stock in major cities as a latent potential in energy and carbon savings. So when we understand what the potential is citywide or district-wide, you can then convert or use that energy savings to afford other projects to happen with little or no impact to the grid. So when I talk about the idea of 68 million kilowatts per year, and that equating to 2,500 single-family homes, that's one equation that's possible. Other equations are building, you know, significant projects onto the grid with little or no impact. So that's another way of looking at it.
Mm-hmm. When you talk about, for instance, the insulated glass that might be a solution to making the building more energy efficient, I would imagine the upfront cost of that, the capital cost of that, would be quite great. How long does it take to pay off that capital expense through energy savings?
Specifically, the exterior wall specifically, I couldn't quote you a specific number on just that system. However, that's a good question because it leads into the kind of economics of these kinds of projects. The overall investment on the building, we're hoping to recoup in 7 to 10 years or so. The requirement for most developers is a 5 to 7 year payback. And on the projects that we're doing now, not just Willis, but other projects, we're definitely within that time frame. So the kind of energy savings and implementation in existing buildings has become much more attractive. And I just read last night that there will be a study coming out from someone in New York that's going to outline the kind of LEED and energy savings on existing buildings as having little or no impact on the economics of the buildings themselves. Why is this important in terms of the relationship of the exterior wall to the overall project? That's because we have to start looking at systems and buildings in a kind of life cycle and holistic relationship. In other words, while it is valuable for the exterior wall to be seen as an investment, that then ties to how we can use the exterior wall to help reduce the artificial lighting load, how that impacts the mechanical systems, what are the ties to indoor air quality and the quality of environment and production in that space. So there are a lot of little threads attached to any single system when we pursue it. So as we look at the impact or return on investment on a single system, it's tied to a number of other systems as well.
Is that something that today architects and developers still have a problem understanding?
It is. I think even today, I think the capital expenditure on buildings is what drives decisions. And I think we're beginning to see a shift in that culture and understanding the long-term investment and the life cycle costs on buildings, but it's still measured as a first cost or that first hit is what a lot of people look at.
In other words, without the subsequent operating cost over the life of the building.
The operating cost as well as the return on the energy. You know, if I can cut your energy bill at home by 40%, and that has a value of, I don't know, $1,000 a year, but I told you it was going to cost you $3,000 to upgrade your home, that's a 3-year payback. After that, that $1,000 a year goes in your pocket. And so is that of value to you? And most people would say yes, and it depends if they want to keep that home for more than 3 years or not.
Right, which gets into the question of what's the developer's time frame.
Exactly. And one thing that's also interesting about that is that the tenants now are much more sophisticated than they were 5 years ago or even 3 years ago. And so what's happening is that as they pursue new space, their cultures are demanding highly sustainable environments. So CEOs of major companies have their own kind of mandates now on the evaluation of space that they occupy. And one of the first questions they ask is, what are your sustainable measures? Because they're thinking about the lifestyle and quality of the environment that their staff works in. And so you're seeing developers kind of respond to that now in a much more rigorous way.
I know you're working with tall buildings throughout the world, some of the world's tallest buildings, in fact. What is it you would like to be able to do in both the Willis Tower and those other developments, which I want to get into, but those buildings that you're designing, what would you like to be able to do that today you cannot do?
Okay, there are a couple of things there. I think that we have the potential to look at programming buildings in a much more sophisticated way in order to offer the notion of a vertical city or a lifestyle that is conducive to reduced energy, reduced carbon, and improved lifestyle. You know, the Hancock does that. You know, there's a grocery store on 44, I think, or so. There's office, there's residential, there's shopping, and so on. Programming vertical buildings is critical in understanding two things. One is the lifestyle, and the other one is the energy sharing or the shaving of peak load energy by programming. Let me try and explain what I mean by that. When you map the peak loads for office use, it's a high peak in the daytime. When you map the peak loads for residential, it's a high peak in the morning when people get up before they leave, and it's a high peak in the evening when they come home and prepare dinner, so on. And we pay premiums to the energy companies at those peak times. That's the most expensive energy you can buy. The idea that we have is to shave that peak load and shift the energy between the office building and the residential buildings. So as the office goes quiet in the evenings, its energy is shifted over to help the residential project, and vice versa, the residential project in the daytime, its energy sources can shift over to help the office building in the daytime to bring the demand down in both cases. So it's a much more flat kind of energy use. Now, you can do this in a single building, or you can do this if you're a single owner that has multiple buildings on a site. What we're pursuing actually is looking at this across blocks and across cities. And that is a demand on policy. It's a demand on information sharing. It's a demand on the kind of understanding of energy use by tenant, by building, by block. We've actually been working with the city of Chicago to pursue this idea, and we're getting a lot of interest from institutions and cities around the country to help them understand how to do this.
And so if you were to pursue that and you were to pursue it on existing blocks, not in green fields, what would it, and not with new buildings, what would that mean? What would that look like in practice?
In practice, that would mean that there is a mechanism, both financial and technical or mechanical, to allow energy to be shifted from one building to another. That means that you're going to pay less for your energy use, but you're going to have an agreement with someone else to understand that as they share energy with you, you're going to pay less, but you're going to be willing to accept that energy from another building or another block, and vice versa. So there's going to be a shared nodal point for energy in a city that allows it to distribute energy to where it's needed the most at any given time. So that's an infrastructure implementation, and the policies are going to have to follow suit. And I can tell you that there's a tremendous amount of interest with this in the city right now, and we're actually putting a book together on this subject as we speak.
Oh, it sounds exciting. Tell me this. What's the role of the energy company in that scenario?
The energy company, they typically get involved to understand how they can assist in distributing energy more equally. They understand that in doing so, they are not hit with building more facilities to provide more energy, but the redistribution of that energy to greater buildings and greater tenancy. So they're actually expanding their client base, I should say, without expanding their building needs, because they themselves have to put forth tremendous amount of capital to build energy plants.
Describing your firm, you say architecture has a unique power to influence civic life. Describe the relationship between the power of architecture and civic life.
Well, what we are pursuing is an improved environment for living, both internally and externally. So in the reprogramming of buildings, for example, or in the energy and carbon reduction of buildings, we are hoping to provide users and people with places to live that are of a superior quality, including things like air quality, but things like daylighting and views, habitable spaces with terraces and landscape, but integrating the kind of civic environment to a higher level of standard that is currently existing in cities today. It includes transit. It includes open space. It includes the built environment as buildings are described. And it includes an understanding of what people need to live better. And we're not suggesting that we have all the answers to that, but we're certainly hoping that we can contribute to that.
What do you think it is that people need to live better today? What do you think are the big pressure points?
I think transportation is one. I think, you know, people spend a tremendous amount of time in their automobiles getting from place A to place B. I think the programming of cities can be heavily improved to help that. I think open space and available green space in your living environment and in your city is critical. I think comfort and better quality of the air quality, both indoor and outdoor, is important for that. A lot of things that we do are tied to health and welfare. And interestingly enough, some of the most interesting questions we get are from insurance companies.
Really? Insurance companies? That's fascinating.
Because insurance companies, in general, insurance companies want you to be well. They want the preventative measures to be taken because that keeps you healthy. So they are willing to promote and invest in a better environment. And there was a study, although I can't quote the source, on a major company that invested in the health and welfare of their employees and implemented exercise and better diet. They improved their workspace in terms of daylighting. And from 1975 to 2000, they saved $1 billion in lost time in sickness and in claims for their insurance company. And that's a significant number. Their production went up, their claims went down. There are a lot of reasons why I say that these ideas are tied to many aspects of living, because they do. It's not just about the building. We build buildings because we want to live better, not because we need more buildings. So the lifestyle and the civic life or the quality of civic life, I think, is at the core of why we're trying to do what we're doing.
And just to go back and make it clear, when you talk about, for instance, transportation as being a real problem, a pressure point, and that you think could be solved in part by better programming of cities, what you really mean is the way things lay on the land, the way uses are mixed and in proximity with one another. Is that fair?
Yes, that's fair. Density is a part of that. We work in cities now where there are programs that promote eco-density, which means densifying certain urban environments in an eco-friendly way, because I think traditionally densification has always been seen as bad. You don't really want to live in the dense city because it's dark and there's a lot of pollution and a lot of traffic and it's just a bad place to live, when in fact it is now understood that although buildings can be responsible for 40 up to 70% of carbon in major cities, the carbon footprint of cities that are more dense is less than the carbon footprint of cities that are less dense, because you have to travel great distances to get back and forth between your home or to go and get a newspaper and things like that. Whereas in densely populated, well-programmed cities, you can walk. And so transportation, public transportation or mass transit is a big part of that.
So eco-density may be finally the way that we sell density?
I think it's definitely a part of it. I think it's a part of it. And, you know, I don't—
It does sound more appealing, doesn't it, than density? I mean, since people, as you say, tend to respond poorly to the idea of density, perhaps slapping eco on the top of it, will make it more appealing.
Yeah. Well, hopefully we integrate eco into it as opposed to just kind of tacking it on the end to make it sound good. But you're right. You're absolutely right. And I think a part of that is not just about the way the buildings are produced, but it's part the way the buildings are designed and the kind of spaces that they afford people to live in. So I think you are seeing a much more sensitive approach to the quality of environment and the way people live now in design. I see it a lot, not just from us.
Local context is an important factor in your work. But as you design buildings in many parts of the world, including you've been very active in the Middle East, in Dubai in particular, as you design buildings in so many parts of the world, how do you master local context?
Well, for me personally, it's looking at their historic buildings, pre-technological solutions for things like air conditioning and, you know, elevators, that kind of stuff. If you look at most historic buildings in these environments, they perform very well. There's a deep understanding of the weather and the wind, the climate, and the way of life. And if you can capture the essence of that and transfer that to a contemporary solution, you're well on your way to doing something that's culturally specific, environmentally specific, and acceptable to that region. I did this on Masdar. Masdar is very much like that. Masdar headquarters.
And Masdar headquarters are where?
The Masdar headquarters is in Abu Dhabi. It's 1.5 million square foot office building. It's 8 stories tall. but it will be the best performing building in the world at 103% positive energy. It creates more energy than it uses on an annual basis.
And obviously you've described earlier that is the result in thinking holistically and in system terms, but if you were advising not architects and not developers, but people who are thinking about buildings and where they choose to live, where they choose to invest, what should they be looking for?
In terms of an environment?
In terms of sustainability, do you simply look at overall performance, which sometimes can be hard to understand, or are you looking for particular technologies that have been used, or simply it's a place that feels good to be?
Yeah, that's a tough question to answer, because I think it's all of the above. I think you first have to find somewhere that is comfortable to your lifestyle. I think you have to look at a variety of amenities that are available to you. I think you should look at the economics of the city or the district or the neighborhood that you're moving into, and question how they treat or how they manage open space, how they manage waste, what is the master plan for that area, and how is it being pursued? Is it an eco-friendly approach to solving the density or the growth? You know, I think you have to look at air quality. In the end, I think most people choose to live where they feel they'll be happiest. That's a lot of different things. I think a lot of different people look for a lot of different things when they're searching for somewhere to live or work.
Gordon, it's been a pleasure talking with you. I know you're busy. Thanks for joining us on Smart City.
No, it's my pleasure, and thank you for having me today.
Gordon Gill has designed award-winning architecture all over the world. We have a link to some of his work on our website, smartcityradio.com. And now for the latest in the world of urban planning and design, we turn to Nate Berg of Plan Edison.
On the Galapagos Islands off the coast of Ecuador, there's a new invasive species wreaking havoc on the sensitive tropical environment. But it's not a voracious tree beetle or some stowaway fungus. It's people. A recent article from the New York Times looks at the rising population of humans on the Galapagos Islands and how they are creating a very negative impact on the environment. The population of humans has skyrocketed over the last decade, doubling to 30,000 people total, an increase linked to the expansion of the tourism industry on the islands. But now, with so many people, the finches Charles Darwin studied in the 1800s are pecking at food scraps in the huge garbage dumps of waste created by humans. To fight what environmentalists are calling a devastating impact on the Galapagos, the government of Ecuador has begun kicking people off of the islands. Over the last year, they've removed 1,000 Ecuadorians from the islands, and more expulsions are expected to follow. But among those being kicked off the islands, the move by the government is a slap in the face. The majority of them are poor and had simply followed jobs out to the Galapagos, where they saw an opportunity to create a living for themselves. But now they're being told that the environment of the islands is more important than their well-being. Though many say they plan to stay on the islands, the government is expected to crack down the growing population and bring this invasive species down to a more sustainable level. Meanwhile, in the United States, there's another blight on the landscape that people are trying to fight. This time, it's empty storefronts. The economic recession has caused many small businesses to go under, and this is especially true in America's small towns. But as a recent article from Time discusses, locals are not letting these empty stores sit idle. One real estate development company reports that it has branched out to try to find new tenants, any tenants, to take over and occupy these unused spaces. From health clinics to auction houses to art galleries and sound stages, former storefronts are finding new lives during this recession. But it's not just what's going into these buildings. Some storefronts are simply being used for their street-facing walls, where window space and even entire facades are being leased to advertisers. Though a billboard or an auction house may not be the best replacement for a corner store that's been run out of business, it seems that beggars can't be choosers in this poor economy. For Plan Edison, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is the assistant editor of PlanEdison.com. Coming up after the break, we'll talk with Julia Parzan of the Urban Sustainability Directors Network about tackling climate change both in policy and in our built environment. I'm Carol Coletta. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. From working in socially conscious mutual funds to her current company, JP Consulting, my guest, Julia Parson, has had a distinguished career as an environmental advocate. These days, she's working with the City of Chicago on its Climate Action Plan and is the director of the Urban Sustainability Directors Network, a group of sustainability directors from around the world. Are we making, Julia, any real progress on our climate change goals in the U.S.?
The progress we're making is that over 900 cities now have plans, and cities are where a lot of the innovation and activity is taking place. What we don't have yet so much of is actions to implement those plans. But in large part because of ARRA and the federal stimulus package, cities all over the country are putting together programs. I'd say there's a lot happening.
What sorts of programs are they putting together that will make a real difference in climate change?
Well, you've probably seen the McKinsey reports. They've done several reports now showing that the return on investment of energy efficiency is about as good as you're going to get right now in this financial market or on Main Street. And so the one thing that I'd say almost every city is trying to do is figure out how to scale up retrofits of housing and businesses to make them a lot more energy efficient, which is also going to save a lot of money.
Describe today what our climate change goals are in the U.S.
Well, we've been working for a long time to try to get federal goals, as you know, and the U.S. did not sign the Kyoto agreements, but we're getting closer. Scientists agree that we don't want to raise the average temperature more than 2 degrees. That's a reduction in greenhouse gas emissions to 80% below 1990 levels by 2050. And that's actually the goal that the city of Chicago adopted and many cities are adopting. So some say 50% below, 70%, 80% below. The point is we're talking about a very big reduction. But there's a lot of things in play that are going to help us to get there.
You've brought up two things for me. First, where is the low-hanging fruit? Is there anything about achieving that 80% reduction that's easy?
There's never anything that's easy. There's things that seem very easy on paper, and 5 years from now, they will have been easy. So going back to this residential and commercial retrofits, right now we have the technology. A lot of homes, we're talking about things as simple as better insulation, and the payback is within a few years on these investments. So the main thing now, the main challenge, is figuring out how to get a lot more households to do it, how to make it so easy for a household to make this change that everyone's going to do it, that they don't have to pay any money up front. And why should they? Because you can borrow this money, someone else can borrow the money, and pay off the loan with the energy savings. Picking contractors, everyone's intimidated by this. You've got to make that so easy that you can go to a certified contractor or list of contractors and you just do it. So what I see a lot of cities doing now is trying to create one-stop shops. So cities are doing a lot of retrofits. They're doing retrofits in the thousands. But what they want to do is do them in the tens of thousands. And these one-stop shops are going to be what makes it possible.
Is there an incentive for energy providers, the ComEds of the world, to provide this one-stop service? So in other words, I keep paying my same energy bill each month, but my energy bill has actually been lowered because they've come in and done the energy retrofit for me. They financed it, and then I'm paying them back over time.
That's a great question, and it's kind of everyone's dream for it to work that way. And in a few states and in a few cities, the utility is playing that role. But more often what's happened is that utilities are concerned about playing that role. They don't want, for example, let's say that someone doesn't want to pay their energy bill. who's gotten these energy improvements. They don't want to turn off their power. They don't want to be in that situation. I mean, some have figured out that this is actually a really positive marketing pitch to make to customers. We're going to pay for you to have a lower bill. And so in certain states, they love it. But the interesting thing that's happened in the last couple of years is that cities have figured out how to do this even if they can't get the utility to be the primary provider. And what they're doing is they're finding ways to use property tax bills, utility assessments, and have it that people can get the money up front and they can pay it back off of their property taxes. And this deals with a really important problem, which is sometimes people think, well, I'm only going to be in this house for 3 years. Why would I want to make this improvement and I've got to pay for the whole thing? Well, when you link it to something like a property tax bill or a utility bill, when you move out, the next person just takes it over and they get the rest of the benefit. But the truth is, even if you're only going to live in a home for a couple of years, there are so many things that you can do now that would give you a positive return on investment, 12, 15, maybe 20%. And we know that's not what you're going to get on a CD.
You are convening for the first time the people in charge of sustainability and climate change mitigation in cities across America. That's, I think, an enormously exciting opportunity. What do you expect the agenda to be?
Well, we just put this group together in April, and already there are 65 cities that are represented, both in the U.S. and Canada. And most of them have been in their position for less than 3 years. Being the director of sustainability for a city is a relatively new position. So I know this is such an easy meeting to have be a success. It's going to be a success no matter what, because just the opportunity for people to meet each other, a lot of them only know one or two other people in the same profession. These are the folks who are in charge of achieving the ambitious goals that their mayors put forward, and they have so much to learn from each other. So I know there's going to be a lot of networking at this meeting. I know there's going to be a lot of sessions with deep content on areas like green infrastructure, on implementing stimulus energy efficiency programs, on zero waste planning, but also a lot of sessions that are on the process of playing this role, which is kind of a new role. It's a brokering role. Most of them have small offices, and their job is not to do things themselves, but to help their cities and all the various departments in them get past the barriers to doing these things. So we're going to have sessions on engaging people at all levels within departments. We're also going to have sessions on public engagement. And all of the sessions we're having, because we asked them, what do you most want to talk to your peers about? And this is what they want to talk about.
I'm going to ask you to name which cities in your mind are today doing the best job on climate change. Who are the leaders?
Well, do you want to only talk about the United States or everywhere in the world?
Let's start with the U.S., because I think it's tougher to come up with cities in the U.S. We're generally farther behind, but let's start with the U.S. and then we'll expand to the rest of the world.
Well, here I am sitting in Chicago, and you know, I have been working on the Chicago Climate Action Plan. I would say that Chicago's plan is recognized across the United States for the quality of the analysis that was done to drive the plan, and also because it has very specific benchmarks for progress. It says how many units of housing will be retrofit. It says what reduction in waste going to landfills will be. A lot of the plans in the United States are still sort of broad and aspirational. So a step forward for Chicago is that it's very concrete, and all of the areas are in implementation and moving forward. I think what defines a great plan in the United States is one where there's a performance management system in place, so a city really knows whether it's making progress and can make mid-course corrections, because we're learning all the time. The environment, the cost of energy is changing all the time. New technologies are changing all the time. And second is it's a city that really engages its public. So take, for example, a city like Portland, which has a very long history of focusing on quality of life and on technology sectors. they're doing a good job on climate change, but they probably aren't that much farther along in terms of the accounting functions of really knowing what progress we're making and whether we're achieving specific goals. A lot of people point to New York City and the Plan New York City, which was not just a climate plan, but a broad, broad regional plan for environment, for economic development, for housing, for land use. And that's another great example because there's so much activity organized around implementation. The best plans right now are ones where you can see a lot of activity on the ground, a lot of policies being passed. Chicago had, as part of its plan, redoing its energy conservation code. That happened within a few months of releasing the plan to the public. So those are a few examples. I think that Minneapolis is a great example too, because it's really been holding itself accountable and sharing annual reports for a long time with the public. And then what I would say is I think there are regions that are very good on particular aspects of this, like the energy efficiency work, again, is very good in Seattle, very good in Portland. I'm mentioning a lot of big cities, though, and I want to also recognize that there are a number of small cities that have done an enormous amount on energy over a very long period of time. This idea I mentioned about the alternative ways of financing energy retrofits first came out of Berkeley, California, and then a different approach to it came out of Babylon, New York, which has about a 70,000 population. So it's not really just how big a city you are, it's how much your mayor's on board, how accountable the city is willing to be, and how inclusive a process you have, including the businesses and residents of a community. So I would say there's only a handful of cities right now that really can show their progress quantitatively. And that, in the end, has got to be the way we judge progress. But there are enormous number of programs, not just on retrofits, but also transportation and waste reduction in cities all over the United States.
And what about the globe?
Things are changing really quickly around the globe. And we've talked a lot about emissions reductions, but always when I think about climate change and climate action for cities, I feel like reducing emissions and adapting to the changes in climate that are already happening have to be looked at together. So I would say on the mitigation side, London is a terrific example. And London has been accountable to demonstrate emissions reductions, and it has achieved them. It's done a huge amount of outreach. But UK has really taken a leadership role on the global stage. And how are we going to help developing countries to manage the climate changes that are happening? So what we're seeing in a lot of developing countries, especially coastal countries, is a lot of thinking about adaptation. How are we going to deal with sea level rise and other issues? And combining that with economic development, and how are we going to develop in a way that doesn't increase emissions? China has just recently been in the news because clearly the Chinese government is realizing this is not just about the environment, this is about economic competitiveness as well. And so China is taking steps in order to have a leadership role in the new energy economy. That's a really important point I just want to emphasize too. The Chicago Climate Action Plan was really presented as a quality of life and prosperity plan. It has emission reduction goals, but just about everything in it is going to improve quality of life and make this a more attractive region. Clearly, that's the way a lot of global countries and cities are thinking about climate change, really about climate prosperity. How are we going to be the ones leading the new energy economy? So you're seeing that now in China, in India, and other places. And I'm hoping all of that will play into discussions about how we have to raise the price of carbon, and the sooner the better.
If all of the sustainability directors that you assemble next month wanted to, could they create a market for particular products, particular processes? If they said, okay, we'll get together and we will become in effect, a market for this new technology, number one, could they do it? Do they have the buying power to do it? And number two, do you think they'd be interested in that? Are there opportunities for that?
Well, I'm really glad that you brought that up, too. I might need to think about that more than I have already. A lot of cities are doing green procurement strategies, and groups like, I know, Delta Institute in Chicago, it's a nonprofit in Chicago, has been organizing both businesses and governments into buyer groups in order to do just that. And truthfully, cities have huge buying power. So one of the things we hope will come out of this meeting, a big part of the second day is going to focus on what these sustainability directors could do together. I suspect a lot of them are so early in the process within their own cities that they're going to want to focus on how do I rev up what I'm doing at home. But that's a great example of the kind of collaboration that could come out of this. And really, the buying power is there. And there is an example already out there that at least the larger cities are part of, which is the Clinton Climate Initiative, which involves the 40 largest cities in the world and a number of banks. And part of the goal of that is to identify technologies that specific cities want to incorporate into their own purchasing and then figure out how to do bulk purchases. There's no reason why regions couldn't do that as well. An interesting aspect of the Energy Efficiency and Conservation Block Grant is that one of the requirements in the block grant legislation is to align energy plans with other cities. That's asking a lot for cities that may not already be collaborating on other things. We don't have regional governance in most parts of the United States. So I think what you're suggesting around green procurement could be a great way to start collaborating. You don't have to change your local decisions, but you can get used to figuring out how to work together in a way that adds value. So that could be a really valuable way to spur this kind of alignment.
You mentioned earlier the concept of adaptation, and I don't think we focus quite on the changes that are now inevitable in terms of climate and the fact that we will have to adapt to those changes. You address that in the Chicago Sustainability Plan. Talk a little bit about that and what sort of changes you're already anticipating to occur in Chicago and how that will affect the city and how we will then need to adapt and what some of those strategies may be.
This was a very strong part of the Chicago Climate Action Plan. We hired climate scientists who were part of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change of the United Nations to do analysis, to do projections for Chicago of what might happen to weather, heat, precipitation. But then we were also lucky enough to get pro bono assistance from Oliver Wyman, and they worked with all the departments in the city to figure out what these changes would mean for each department, for parks, for schools, everything, for roads, transportation. And we used that to put together our adaptation plan. And of course, a city like Chicago, we're pretty lucky. We're not going to see the worst impacts. We're not a coastal city. We're not very close to the equator where the worst impacts will be. But nonetheless, we could see by the end of the century summers where there are 30 days over 100 degrees. That's going to radically change quality of life in the city and the kind of city it is. In fact, what we did to make this easy to understand is we used an analytic tool called Migrating Climate to show what the climate in Chicago would be like by 2080. And it would be like living in Houston or Baton Rouge. Those are fine cities. They're great to live in if that's where you want to live. But is it the Chicago we want to live in? So what we found was we were going to have to change a lot in order to adapt to a much hotter climate. What we also found was we were going to have a lot more rain and not when we needed it. So a lot more winter rain, more accidents, more flooding. What does that mean? It means a lot of work to figure out how to adapt buildings to a warmer climate and a lot of work to figure out how to get more permeable surfaces. That's a big area for the city of Chicago, has been for a long time, green infrastructure, green roofs, green alleys, but these are going to become very important adaptation tools.
How do you get Americans to think about 2080 when it's only 2009?
I think about that a lot, of course, because we have in the climate plan a goal of getting almost half of the residents of the city of Chicago to participate in one program or another of the climate plan. So the first thing I would say is it's easier because there are some changes that are already happening. So a lot of people don't know this, but the growing zone for gardeners for Chicago has already changed. We have passed from one zone to another. This is going to have implications for everyone's gardens, the health of trees. Lots of people are aware that there have been more floods in the city and there are more flooded basements. So you can point to these things to suggest it's not just down the road that we're going to feel those impacts, but this goes back to what really is a climate plan again. And for us, it's a prosperity plan. And so we really have to emphasize the benefits of taking action now and not scare people. So it's saving money, it's green jobs, it's economic development opportunities, and we can point to those happening here. And that's the way most cities, I think, are approaching it.
Julia, thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
I'm very happy to have been here. Thank you.
Julia Parzon is the director of the Urban Sustainability Directors Network and the president of JP Consulting. Finally this week, our City Views commentator gets positively primordial. Walker Smith looks deep into matter to find out what really matters.
We think so much in terms of individuals that it's a bit of a surprise to discover that the building blocks of nature are really no such thing. Relationships are the irreducible essence of nature. There is no such thing as an atom. It is composed of the relationships between its constituent elements, electrons and protons, and these subatomic particles themselves cannot be properly understood absent their relationships with one another. Berkeley physicist Henry Stapp is a world-renowned expert in the mysteries of quantum physics, and he describes the nature of basic building blocks as a set of relationships that reach outward to other things. The work done at massive particle accelerators around the world reveals ever more obscure and fleeting high-energy elementary particles, none of which can be found except through their interaction with intense energy sources, which are themselves composed of other particles that carry the energy and exist only in relationship to other particles. It all gets pretty obscure, but the bottom line is that what we think of as subatomic particles are, in the words of Stapp, nothing but intermediate states in a network of interactions. Relationships, not individual particles, are the essence of nature. The importance of relationships is not unknown to us. Several longitudinal studies have shown that people with wider social networks live longer. And it's a sports chestnut that there is no I in team. Biologist Garrett Hardin once famously described the essence of the environmental and resource challenges we face today as the tragedy of the commons, a problem that occurs when we use and exploit resources in isolation, not in cooperation. Anthropologist Gregory Bateson, the husband of Margaret Mead, was one of the first to demonstrate that human societies can only be understood in terms of what he called an ecology of mind. Computer collaboration software like Lotus Notes was developed specifically to enable people to tap into the productivity advantages that come from deeper relationships around business issues. Social media are the latest rage because they have brought us together in ways that renew old friendships and enable us to find good deals in the consumer marketplace. In short, everywhere we look, the importance of relationships stands out. And yet, in numerous ways, we fail to put into practice what we know about relationships. In particular, we celebrate self-indulgence and self-interest. We put greed on a pedestal. We laud the loner who flouts social conventions and goes his or her own way, independent of everyone else. Individualism stands supreme. And that's not a bad thing, but it is a limited view of human capacity. For the most interesting thing about selfishness is not what it does for the individual, but how it leads to altruism and stronger social relationships. Richard Dawkins, the famous British evolutionary biologist, made his reputation with the 1976 publication of his bestseller, The Selfish Gene. But in the 30th anniversary edition, Dawkins lamented the title because, as he wrote in the introduction to that edition, it gives an inadequate impression of the book's contents. If anything, he wrote, the book devotes more attention to altruism. Because that is the paradox of the selfish gene. It manifests itself in selflessness. That is our true nature, something worth remembering as we sort through in the years to come the role and place of things like markets, government, the American social contract, and, as Ted Kennedy put it in his posthumously delivered letter to President Obama, the character of our country. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is the president of the Yankelevich Monitor, a trend service of the Futures Company. He comes to us each week from Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta. That's it for this week's show, but there's more Smart City Online. Head to smartcityradio.com to check out archive shows, read my blog, and subscribe to our weekly newsletter. You can also let us know how we're doing by emailing us at questions@smartcityradio.com or click on the contact button at our website. Smart City's web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundation, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future for Memphis, Tennessee, and its citizens. For more information, go to HydeFoundations.org. I'm Carol Coletta.